Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
I suspect that many of you might not know it, but this year Unitarians are celebrating the 450th anniversary of the Edict of Torda. Has anyone heard of this? Right, of course, everyone knows. 450 years ago, for those of you who don't know, in the city of Torda in present-day Romania, one of the earliest statements of religious tolerance was issued by a leader. The king was named John Sigismund, and he was a Unitarian. One of the old ilk, a Protestant Christian who didn't accept the Trinity but believed in one God. And this edict recognized Unitarianism officially for the first time, and it made headway in the quest for religious freedom. It read, in part, "In every place the preachers shall preach and explain the gospel, each according to his understanding of it, and if the congregation like it, well. If not, no one shall compel them, for their souls would not be satisfied, but they shall be permitted to keep a preacher whose teaching they approve. No one shall be reviled for his religion by anyone, and it is not permitted that anyone should threaten anyone else by imprisonment, for faith is the gift of God." This statement meant that all the communities, municipalities, could choose for their preacher one that suited their particular theological leanings, rather than have imposed on them one that did not. Various theologies would be tolerated as they served the various peoples of the nation. The UUA website declares that that proclamation is the beginning of our legacy to be a spiritual tradition that resists hatred, oppression, and the narrow view that there is only one way to be faithful, to be religious, to be free. The beginning, our denominational website claims, but certainly not the end. You'll notice, of course, in that edict that Jews, Muslims, others would not fall into this protection. The edict is limited to variations of Christianity that had come up in the wake of Martin Luther's 95 Theses and the Reformation that he somewhat unwittingly started. And so we call it a statement of religious tolerance because that's really what it is. A guarantee that different preachers will be tolerated. It's not actually a statement of acceptance or equality or love that casts a broad net. It's a relatively narrow statement of tolerance that plants a seed. Because we have come to understand that tolerance is not enough. You can tolerate some things that you think are pretty bad. It's not enough to preach tolerance of others, but we have realized that we need to preach actual acceptance, more than that, encouragement, even more than that, actual love. We have to preach the development of real relationship. Now, I don't want to be confusing at all here. Legalized tolerance is still important. The Edict of Torda mentions that folks shall not be imprisoned or threatened with imprisonment just for their religion. It's good to legislate certain things. In fact, there's a very famous quote from Dr. King in which he says just that. He says, "You can't legislate morals. The job must be done through education and religion." Well, there's a half-truth involved here, he says. Certainly, if the problem is to be solved in the final sense, hearts must be changed. Religion and education must play a great role in changing the heart. But we must go on to say that while it may be true that morality cannot be legislated, behavior can be regulated. It may be true that the law cannot change the heart, but it can restrain the heartless. It may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can keep him from lynching me, and I think that's pretty important also. By that practical and important measure, orders like the Edict of Torda, the Emancipation Proclamation, they matter. We know that they matter. And we also know that they didn't change people's hearts and minds. Right after that king, John Sigismund, a new ruler came in who was interested in curtailing that tolerance. Although he was unsuccessful and the edict lasted for about 100 years, it didn't actually change Transylvania or the rest of the world forever. Decrees and orders and laws that enforce tolerance to keep everyone safe are necessary, but they aren't the end of the story, not by a long shot. And we know this here in our own country. We have said over and over in the last year that racism has been made more visible to more of us than it had before. And I say it that way because I think we can agree it was never that this country stopped being racist, but rather that for many of us, our privilege made it possible to not see it. And so I would argue, did the fact that we had ostensible laws on the books to protect people and create equality? Because we do ostensibly have laws on the books about protection and equality. But we have so many layers down in our legal system and so many culturally embedded challenges and so many deeply held prejudices that those laws, while they sometimes worked to protect and force tolerance, they haven't worked to create what we really need, which is the change in people's hearts and minds. A change from fear and hatred, not to tolerance, not even maybe to acceptance, but to genuine welcoming and celebration and love. That's the change we need and the change that we have yet to see on a widespread scale. So often we lift up Martin Luther King on this one day, and often with that clip that we showed during the Time for All Ages, the I Have a Dream speech. We show it and we think to ourselves what a wonderful speaker and preacher he was, what gloriously righteous in the real sense of that word, turns of phrase he used, what rhetorical power and charismatic presence he had, and we think to ourselves that he was the face of a movement that changed this country. And we feel pride in our Unitarian Universalist heritage of support for King and for the civil rights movement. And we should think and feel all those things. But there's this other piece that we don't always lift up and honor. There's lots of pieces to Dr. King, complexities that we don't always want to look at. And this year, as I was reading through his words, I was struck again by the letter from Birmingham Jail. I had read it before, and it had had resonance in the past, but this year it had more, because white people helped elect our current administration. White people went to the polls and tried to elect an accused predator to the Senate. We cannot pretend anymore, if we ever really could, that we don't have a problem with racism in this country. And I know it's not the first time I've said that, and you know it won't be the last. It feels especially important to say it today, because this day, this Sunday, when so many Unitarian Universalists around the country are honoring King's legacy, I worry that this day acts as a salve to our collective conscience. But the letter, it helps remind us that the work of changing minds and hearts ought to be universal, ought to be our work, even though it hasn't always been. It reminds us that we have work to do, ways to show up better, if we want to participate in and support the liberating movement for justice that continues to this day. The letter, as you heard, contains this sense of deep disappointment. Here King was sitting in a jail in Birmingham, and he's getting these messages from other clergy, Christian and Jewish clergy, asking him to slow down, to wait, to try different tactics, not the nonviolent direct actions he's been using. He answers them in this letter that he jokingly acknowledges goes on so long that it's basically a book. And he says, even worse in some ways than the outright racist KKK are the moderates who even well-meaningly get in the way of change, who preach patience and slowness, who say, well, there are two sides to things, or who do lip service to the just but then live their lives in ways that perpetuate the unjust. And he's disappointed in the church that fails to step into the breach and demand justice in the ways that it did in the time of Jesus. There's a tension. There's a tension in our own Unitarian Universalist activism, in our celebration of our own history of righteousness, in our lifting up of the successes that leaders like King and others have helped bring about. He notes it well. Those of us who have not lived as the oppressed cannot know what that is like, and so don't come as easily to the call to change. Now, please know that throughout the letter, and I recommend you go read it, throughout the letter, he lifts up the exceptions to that rule, often by name, but they are exceptions. The majority of white people throughout the country have been able to escape or ignore the sense of urgency that motivated King, that motivates leaders like Alicia Garza, Reverend William Barber, and others on the front lines of civil rights work to this day. So for all this, for all my worry about a salve, I showed that speech, right? Do you want to know why? I showed it because when you listen, when you really listen, you hear a call to a different world that does feel urgent. And when you take it alongside King's reminders in the letter of what is right and just and good, the urgency begins to build. And when you let yourself be reminded that he lived in a world of lynching and we live in a world of 21st century equivalent through militarized policing and aggressive imprisonment and disproportionate penalizing, it begins to become even more urgent. This is a call, an urgent call to something different, something better. It's a call to what King called the beloved community. That's a phrase that we bandy about a lot in our progressive religious circles. King popularized the term, but it was first used by a late 19th, early 20th century Christian philosopher, Josiah Royce. Royce's use really gets a universalized, modified brush with King's adoption of the term. So what is that? What is the beloved community? It is, in part, the world in the picture he paints in the I Have a Dream speech. It is, in part, the mountaintop he speaks of in the speech he gave before he was killed. It is, in part, the world where all the valleys have been raised and the hills made low, and it has roots as a Christian term. We can see that. And he uses it that way. But it is not itself a singularly Christian term. It takes on a bigger, broader meaning as he develops it over the course of his life. It's a term that encapsulates the method, the end goal, and sets a prophetic vision for what can be. In 2004, the activist Grace Lee Boggs wrote a piece entitled "The Beloved Community of Martin Luther King." And in it she wrote, "These are times that try our souls. I cannot recall any previous period when the challenges have been so basic, so interconnected, so demanding, not just to specific groups, but to everyone living in this country, regardless of race, ethnicity, class, gender, age, or national origin. As I have read and reread King's speeches and writings from the last 2 years of his life, it has become increasingly clear to me that King's prophetic vision is now the indispensable starting point for 21st century revolutionaries. These are times that try our souls," she wrote. And I think that's as true in this moment as it was when she wrote it 13 years ago. She goes on to describe the beloved community King spoke of. She lifts up the complexity of King's later vision as a struggle not just against racism, but against many of the evils of our culture, ones that are still regnant: militarism, poverty, materialism. His vision, Boggs writes, was more radical than just the hand-holding of the I Have a Dream speech. It is a world in which people took center stage, relationships, love, rather than machines, technology, material goods, and racism. As Boggs put it, those things disappear in the face of people at the grassroots and community level participating in creating new values, truths, relationships, and infrastructures as the foundation. And they disappear because a radical culture shift takes place. King constantly pointed out, writes Boggs, that the refusal of those in the freedom movement to respond in kind to the violence and terrorism of their opponents was increasing their own strength and unity. He reminded them and the world that their goal was not only the right to sit at the front of the bus or to vote, but to give birth to a new society based on more human values. Beloved community is the one in which relationships, respect, truth, human values have been birthed anew. It is the one in which, as King declared over and over, reconciliation, redemption, and love have transformed opponents into friends. The pursuit of a radically changed culture, a radically changed world, through nonviolent action and a turn toward love, was not about winning. That was not the point. The point was to create a community of love, a beloved community that cared more about transforming hearts and minds than about winning. As the King Center puts it, for Dr. King, the beloved community was not a lofty utopian goal to be confused with the rapturous image of the peaceable kingdom in which lions and lambs coexist in idyllic harmony. Rather, the beloved community was for him a realistic, achievable goal that could be attained by a critical mass of people committed to and trained in the philosophy and methods of nonviolence. Dr. King's beloved community is a global vision in which all people can share in the wealth of the earth. In the beloved community, poverty, hunger, and homelessness will not be tolerated because international standards of human decency will not allow it. Racism and all forms of discrimination, bigotry, and prejudice will be replaced by an all-inclusive spirit of sisterhood and brotherhood. In the beloved community, international disputes will be resolved by peaceful conflict resolution and reconciliations of adversaries instead of military power. Love and trust will triumph over fear and hatred. Peace with justice will prevail over war and military conflict. That's the vision. A world ruled by love, nonviolence, reconciliation, and redemption for every person. A completely changed world in which human values take precedence and love triumphs over all hate. This is the vision that should cause every single one of us to have a sense of urgency. This vision that moves so far beyond tolerance as to bear very little relationship to it. This vision is of a world that is still yet to come. We acknowledge that we are not there. But this is the vision that we should embrace and celebrate and seek after day in and day out. This beloved community that he sought is the place in which all of us are welcome and safe and free to work and learn and love and exist. The call to this beloved community is as radical and revolutionary a shift in our way of being in the world as can be. It is a call to be different ourselves. And by being different ourselves, to shift the world, transforming hearts and minds. That way of being different included embracing a sense of urgency, committing to direct actions, but it also included reorienting oneself entirely toward love, beyond tolerance, into a place of deep human relationality. And so this is our call then, to be the best allies and supporters we can of the work of the oppressed toward liberation, by not slowing the movement down, by ceasing to perpetuate the systems of oppression that benefit us, by refusing to be complicit in racism and prejudice. And the call is to recognize ourselves as complicit in and victims of a larger system of dehumanization that can only be changed by a radical revolution in society. And so we are called to go on marches and write letters and give money and also to revolutionize our own way of being in the world by embracing hope, loving those who hold a different view than we do, and holding before us constantly the vision of a world ruled not by fear, but a world in which every single human heart is honored as never before. So may it be.